another edition of The Pedal Shift Project. The Pedal Shift Project is a series of conversations, thoughts, and experiments around the bike touring lifestyle, from tips and tricks to ideas on how to tour more. Let's shrink the world by bike. You can read more on pedalshift.net, email the show pedalshiftproject@gmail.com. Check out Pedal Shift also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And you can find the show notes for this episode at pedalshift.net/040. Dude, we're like middle-aged. We're like 40 now. Isn't that crazy? Coincidentally, also, 40 happens to be the number of the anniversary year for the bike centennial. I don't know how much history people have out there on bike touring. If you're new, if you maybe you could be around with bike touring for a long time and not really care too much about what the history is. I covered a little bit on the show. Of course, you know, I talked about Annie Londonderry earlier last year. But this year is a really big deal. 1976 is sort of, I think, the beginning of the modern bicycle touring movement with the bike centennial. And in 1976, I was 5 years old. I rode a bike in a parade. It was kind of cool. I remember it's one of my earliest memories of riding a bike. So 1976 for me as the bicentennial for the US was kind of a big deal. But for bicycle touring, it was a very big deal because that was the year that what later became the Trans Am route, then the bike centennial route down through pretty much the gut of the United States, cross country from, I believe it's from Virginia to Oregon, if I'm not mistaken. That was sort of done for the first time in a real way. I'm sure that route was done before by others, but this was not necessarily so much organized as it was an event. And from that point on, the Adventure Cycling Association came out of the organization that was behind all of that. So really the modern concept of bike touring started around that time. At least that's a place to mark it. So this year is kind of a big deal for bike touring. So a whole bunch of things are happening as a result of that in the bike touring world. And the bike centennial turning 40, Adventure Cycling is certainly doing something about it. I mean, they were there sort of at the outset of this mark of modern bicycle touring history. And they're doing some cool things this year in addition to all of the usual stuff that they do. They're doing a Bike Your Park Day on September 24th. And that's sort of, I think, their way of marking in partnership with the National Parks Service the bike centennial itself. So there's a place, and I've got a link in the show notes, where you can actually register a ride if you're going to be doing any kind of a bike tour on the weekend of or around September 24th. You can register that and it can show up, and there's already a ton of different rides, and they're all sort of linked to a national park in one way or another. So of course there's a bunch of people who are riding the CNO that weekend. That's a really popular weekend anyways. Late September, your leaves are still going to be fully there. You'll have your green tunnels, but it'll be a little bit cooler than the usual kind of, you know, 8,000 degrees that we have in the DC area. So that's a good weekend to do it if you're thinking about doing it. But regardless, you know, if you're thinking about doing a tour that will include a national park and you want to kind of make your mark, you can do that through the Adventure Cycling Association's website. Again, link in the show notes at pedalshift.net/040. Sometimes I get confused between the project and the show. It's in the websites. It's just crazy like that. So that's September 24th. I think it's something that is interesting and good for Adventure Cycling Association to be doing, to be marking this. I think I'm not huge on anniversaries myself personally, or birthdays, really more birthdays than anything else. But, you know, 40 is kind of a big number, and I think it's good they're going to be recognizing a lot of that kind of stuff. And, you know, it is interesting to see the history. I've been seeing a lot of folks, I believe the folks from Path Less Pedaled are playing around in their sort of day jobs. I think they do a lot of stuff around bicycle touring and tourism. And they're playing around with some videos and some footage from back in 76. And there seems to be some really good stuff that I've been seeing on Instagram and elsewhere from them. So I'm hoping to see, I don't know, maybe some mini documentaries, things along those lines. If anybody is listening to this show who participated in the bike centennial back in the day, would love to chat with you, maybe even have you on the show and talk about your experience. I think I've had a few people reach out before about that, or at least I've run into people back in the fall when I did that Amtrak adventure, that kind of overnight where I would bike out to Harper's Ferry. I did that a couple weekends, not in a row, but within a few weekends of each other. I ran into one guy who said that he had done it, and it was interesting talking to him and seeing his experiences and whatnot. So if any listeners out there, friends of the show or otherwise, who have done the bike centennial route, did the Trans Am back in the day in 76 in particular, I'd really be interested in hearing from you. So you can shoot me an email, pedalshiftproject@gmail.com. Next up is The Journal, and The Journal is the portion of the show for all you newcomers where we talk about your tours, my tours, people's tours. And one thing that I want to start off with this year was to talk a little bit about where I'm at for the spring and beyond. I'm sort of in the mode in the winters, and I've talked about this before on the show, where I'm just sort of dreaming up ideas and rides and things like that. Of course, everybody met MJ, Mysterious James, last episode, and you'll get part two next week. But he and I started noodling around an idea about doing a spring ride in California, and I think that's starting to finalize. I don't know, I don't have final details yet, but probably a mid-coast ride going south from San Francisco to either maybe as far as Santa Barbara, perhaps just San Luis Obispo. It just sort of depends on what time I have available during that time. And that'll be fun because I'll do a tour journal podcast for that. James will be along. I don't know how much he'll participate. We'll see. We'll see what we can do. I think all of your great feedback on his appearance last episode might maybe get him to be a part of it at least a little bit, or at least we'll do a longer interview, maybe by fire, sort of like what we did last spring with Nathan Clevenger. So lots of things there. So spring tour in California, probably going to be one of my first bigger rides of 2016. So stay tuned for that. The other thing I'm considering, and this is sort of a question for the listeners, would anybody be interested in doing a sort of loosely affiliated ride, a loosely affiliated pedal shift ride, where it would start in Washington, D.C. and end with sort of a barbecue at my cabin in West Virginia. It would be sort of a 2-day weekend ride. Don't know about dates. Don't think it would be anything specifically organized. I would probably organize enough so that there would be like a cost for the party or something afterwards. People could either camp out if there's it depends on how many people would be interested in this, but this is a half-baked idea of all half-baked ideas. So I've got a link in the show notes at pedalshift.net/040, and just throw me your email if you're interested. And like I said, this is something that's sort of a half-baked idea. If anybody would be interested in doing some kind of a ride with a group of like-minded people, expectations wise, it would probably be we'd all sort of bike on our own, but we'd camp together at particular spots and then end up at my place in West Virginia for the final night. So if you're interested, then just go to pedalshift.net/040 and scroll down, and there's going to be like a little form where you can throw your email in there. That way I can keep track of y'all. So yeah, let me know if you're interested in that. And if not, that's cool too. That would be probably in the late summer, early fall. That would probably be September. I don't know if it would coincide with that bike centennial bike your park day. That might be probably a really crowded weekend to do it if there's going to be a lot of people out there on the CNO, since that's also our national park, but somewhere in that range, perhaps. Next up is gear talk. We've got a lot of gear talk. I basically have stuff going all the way back to mid-December for gear talk because there was a lot of stuff that was going on that I couldn't fit into the holiday spectacular quite so well, and it was after the first show. First up is from a Brompton rider, and I want to make sure that I am properly letting this person give that person, Darren Beek, he's at Bike Pedantic. He had an issue. This was on December 15th, and he was flying. Unclear where, I don't think I have where he was flying from or to. However, he was flying Delta Airlines, and I think I might have to pull out the Flaming Sword of Justice music for this one, because I have a bit of a rant on Delta and particularly on how they treated this Brompton flyer. Let's go with the Flaming Sword of Justice rant music. TLDR, or the TLDL, too long, don't listen. When you're flying with a Brompton, I definitely encourage you to go stealth mode, fuck Delta, and fuck Brompton traders who work for Delta. So there's my explicit tag, two in a row. All right. So Darren was flying with his Brompton, and he had it, sadly, and I think this is where he got busted on this. He had it in a carrying case that, of course, has the Brompton logo on it, which is really obvious. It's got bikes on it. So he writes on Twitter, and I caught this sort of almost in real time. Delta just charged me $150 one way for this piece of luggage. Guess why? So basically, he got tagged for the bicycle fee by Delta, and the he tried all the different tricks. He tried everything. Now, he was trying to check it as normal luggage. And as far as I can tell, that should fit within the regular luggage requirements, you know, size and weight requirements, well within the weight requirements. But somehow he got tagged with that bike fee. And the thing that was kind of crazy was a woman, Jessica Roberts, at Jessica Roberts, asked, hey, how did they know? And Darren, at Bike Pedantic, says, one of the other gate agents has one. His amiable small talk was a trap. To which, of course, I replied with the classic Admiral Akbar, it's a trap animated GIF. You can I'll check that out on, actually, I think I have it on my website at pedalshift.net/Brompton. You can check all of that out under the very important part now, which is called stealth mode, why it's really important to use stealth mode with your Brompton. It's really annoying that airlines are not universal. They don't have consistency when it comes to dealing with bikes. We've talked about this in a variety of different ways on a variety of different shows. But with a Brompton, especially, it looked like he was trying to check this as luggage. This should never have gotten the bike fee. It just should never have. But at the gate agent level, they have so much power and they have so much ability to sort of tag you. Now, I'm hoping that he was able to get a refund on this, because I don't think that there was any reason why that checked Brompton should have gotten tagged with that bike fee. I think it was within the realm of it. The only problem that he had was that he had a Brompton branded bag that had a bike on the side of it. And that sucks that was the way that he got tagged. Even worse, the gate agent that sort of outed him by recognizing all of that and started going, oh yeah, do you have a Brompton in there? Oh yeah. Oh, I got one too. Yeah. Nice. Fuck you, dude. So, that is one of the reasons why, and I spent a whole podcast talking about this, that making sure that you are in stealth mode when you've got a Brompton or any other kind of folding bike that can fit up there. I think Turns can fit up there and a few others as well, potentially. Although I haven't tried, so don't try that. Don't try this at home unless you know. Make sure that you are hiding that bike, and make sure that at two very critical spots, you're ensuring that you're not showing off that your Brompton is a bike. Number one is at the gate. Let me back up. Actually, this is at the ticket counter where he got tagged. I always am going to be trying to take mine on board as carry-on. And that was what he wasn't trying to do. I think that in some ways you have a better chance of getting around that. Now, if you do have to check a bag and you do have to go to the ticket counter and check a bag, well, you know what? Make sure that thing's covered up. Make sure that it is sort of not in visible sight. You know, if you have it really close to the desk and out of their line of sight, then they're not going to be able to see it. And the other thing I would say is, and this sucks, but the fact that you've got to cover up a Brompton logo or any other logos or anything on your bags that suggest that something inside is a bike if you're trying to avoid the bike fees. Now, I'm not saying that we should cheat out the airlines on this kind of a thing, but a Brompton fits within what their published limits are. It folds up small enough so it's not oversized, and it's light enough so it's not overweight. So you shouldn't have to pay a bike fee just because it happens to be a bike, because those are specifically, and if you read all of these things like I have, hi lawyer, right? They're saying that usually bikes that fit smaller than these guidelines don't get charged this amount. Delta is one of those, but they screwed them anyway. So that's really unfortunate. So that was a giant trap. The other place that's really critical to be in stealth mode is actually not at TSA. TSA, they don't give a, they don't care. They really don't. They want to know what it is. And at that point, you don't want to be hiding what it is. You can obviously tell them it's a bicycle. But when you get to the gate, again, go into stealth mode, have that bike covered up. You know, when you have them covered up with a bag that doesn't have the Brompton logos on that. In fact, the Brompton bike cover does not have a Brompton logo on that. It just looks like a goofy rollerboard bit of luggage. So that's what I always recommend. Darren, unfortunately, got hosed on this one, $150. And because that gate agent or that ticket counter agent hosed him, so screw him. I say bring out the Flaming Sword of Justice music once again. All right, next up on Gear Talk. No more. Hey, that was the first time we had to pull up the Flaming Sword of Justice music. That's pretty crazy. Next up on the Gear Talk section of the show, we're going to talk about tech on the road. Paul Mulvey, friend of the show, Paul Mulvey, rode in a couple of times and has a couple of interesting things that I thought were worth sharing with everyone. The first is a little bit longer. The second, I think, has been resolved. So maybe, well, We'll flip them around. The first one is Google Maps, and I think that's been resolved. There was a period of time, and some of you may have noticed this, where the Google Maps bike layer, so when you do bike directions and or you say you click on the little icon that says show bike routes, they tend to be that dark green line. If you know what I'm talking about, then this all makes perfect sense. If you don't, then go check out Google Maps and you can see it. Apparently for a little while, if you zoomed out enough, Google Maps wouldn't show that bike layer. And that was really frustrating because on longer routes like the CNO and the Gap and other places like that, or even other places where there are long bikeable routes, it wouldn't show up on Google Maps. And that's kind of a drag for doing longer distance tour planning, just to see what's available with longer routes. And apparently it was out past Zoom level 13. I don't know what that is, but that's what Paul is all on top of this. So that's what he had mentioned. Apparently that may have been fixed. It's back to normal, but there was a discussion in Google's product forums. So Paul sent along the link for the product forums at Google, and it's interesting. I think this has all been resolved. It looks like it has been, but it might be worth reading if you're into all this kind of stuff. And give me a holler if any of this ever happens again, because it's just sort of interesting. It's something that you have to choose to show, so it makes no sense why they would pull it out for longer-term views. And I think that's why they reverse course, and it seems to be working better now. So that was the brief brouhaha over Google Maps and bicycle routes. Paul also brought along something interesting that I thought was really good. In 2012 and 2015, he wrote a couple of Crazy Guy on a Bike reviews on bringing technology along for bike touring. And he thought it would be interesting to share with folks on the show. And I totally agree. In 2012, he did a review on comparing a MacBook Air to the original iPad 1 as a way to be able to get work done or to be connected and all that other kind of stuff. And also in 2015, he did a revised version of that, where he wanted to compare the technology of the iPad Air to the MacBook Air. And he came to different conclusions based on the changes in technology. And I thought that was really interesting. Links in the show notes, that's at pedalshift.net/040. And it's Paul Mulvey's, friend of the show, Paul Mulvey's reviews there. And I'll share with you what I've gone through with all of this. And I've changed also along with technology. Now, this is, of course, pretty Apple centric. So for those of you who use different devices, I think that there's analogous devices that use Windows and Android and things along those lines, but your mileage may vary. Also, your needs may vary too. In 2013, I discovered my needs for working on the road meant that the iPad wasn't the best choice for me, but that was based on the type of work that I was doing. I was doing a ton of audio editing, and frankly, if you're in the Mac world, audio editing is still way better in OS X. So like your typical laptops and your MacBooks, your MacBook Airs and stuff like that, rather than your iPads. There is at least one app that I've played around with a little bit that does audio editing in iOS. I'm not sure if it's available in Android or not. It's a little clunky. And of course, everything is different when you move from sort of the mouse and touchpad type of technology to going to the touchscreen. It's something that I haven't gotten used to. I've been doing audio editing for more than 10 years now on a Mac, so I've got kind of a groove well worn in. So I tend to want to use a Mac more than an iOS device, even though I know it's a possibility. When connectivity is key, that's when you start dealing with the smaller devices, with the iOS devices. You know, I've gone so far, as many of you have known, from past tours of touring with an iPhone that I have on AT&T and an iPad mini on Verizon, but also traveling with some SIM cards that include T-Mobile. And I even did it once where I had all these devices and I had a little jetpack type of thing, which is, I think they used to call them MiFis, or at least one of the branded versions of it was MiFi, and that hooked up with Sprint. So I actually had all of the major US carriers covered when I was touring to allow the most possible coverage. And on top of that, I toured with a MacBook Air 11 incher. So, you know, that was when I was still on an unlimited plan with AT&T and couldn't tether that phone. And, you know, so I had all sorts of different things. I still have found, and this is sort of over the top. I mean, I'm on record of talking about how being connected and having technology when I'm touring is important to me. Part of it is to share with the show, doing the Tour Journals podcast. But part of it also is that, you know, often I'm doing work, often I'd like to be in touch, things like that. Having multiple carriers sometimes can make a difference. I know that made a difference in California. I know it made a difference on the Gap in particular, because I wasn't able to get a good signal on AT&T at all, but I could on Verizon, I believe it was. That's usually the case. You'll find that there are some places where some connect better than others. So sometimes carrying multiple devices can help you out, especially if you've got them on different carriers. I find that AT&T works pretty well for me. So I've, for most of my tours, will now take just my active iPhone on AT&T, which is now a 6 Plus. You may remember it from the one that I temporarily lost while on tour last summer. I talked about that on the Holiday Spectacular, of course. I take that and I take my 11-inch MacBook Air with me. And, you know, there's a risk with that, of course. I mean, there's a risk it could get stolen, it could get broken, all those different things. And I recognize that. But it's worth it to me because I'm much more productive on them. I have in the past done some things, and Paul, I think, talks about these kinds of things, you know, making choices based on what your needs are, and maybe not necessarily doing all of having everything with you all at once. But, you know, I found at least in that 2013 tour that the loss in productivity when I was working on just an iPad was just too much of a loss relative to what I wanted to get done. So in other words, I would take full days off to work. I had 0 mile days for working. And I found that it took me a full day to do the things that I needed to do because the efficiency wasn't very high. If I had had my laptop with me, my MacBook Air, it would have been a lot faster. And I might have been able to get it done in maybe half the time. So that's what really changed my mind with technology and all of this. Paul had an evolution as well. So I definitely invite you to go check it out. His Two Crazy Guy and a Bike reviews on technology from 2012 and 2015. The 2012 one's actually a bit of a time machine, even though it's only a few years old. It's talking about the iPad one, which is a bit of a dino now. I don't even think they sell it. I think you can find it every once in a while on eBay, but it's an old machine. So check that all out at the show notes, pedalshift.net/040. And thank you, Paul, friend of the show, Paul Mulvey, for sharing all of this with us. Next up on Gear Talk. See, I told you it's a really long Gear Talk, this show. Following up on bulging tires. So I've talked about this on a couple of instances, and I believe that we talked about it as well with Brock from Sprocket Podcast, talked about it in the interview from last year about how he had a herniating tire. Of course, I had that on my Gap ride when that sort of all failed on me a few times ago. And I believe that was that last spring or the spring before? Man, time flies. So this was really interesting. We've talked about the dollar bill trick. We've talked about tire boots, but this was a new one that I found. Mike Cobb over on one of the bicycle touring forums on Facebook, his name is Mike Cobb. He shared a really awesome idea, and that is cutting a section of a plastic soda bottle to use that as a boot within the tire. So what happen is that you've got the tear, you've got the herniation spot on the tire. You cut a piece of plastic soda bottle extending about, he says, an inch and a half outside of the bulge. And you want to sand down those edges because, of course, when you cut that, it's going to be very sharp. So if you've got a patch kit with sandpaper, or if you've got some pavement, or even maybe a rock or something like that, you know, you want to kind of rub down those edges so that they don't end up poking into your tube. So it goes between your tube and the tire. And he suggests that you duct tape it inside the tire so that it can stop. It wouldn't slide around or move. And I think that's a really, really good idea. Of course, you'll really want to clean out the inside. Otherwise, the duct tape won't stick very well. And he suggests that that can be a permanent solution to a damaged casing on a tire that's wider than an inch and a half. He thinks that narrow tires can also be fixed, but you will still feel the lump in it. And that sounds about right to me. Now, narrower tires tend to be filled up at a higher pound per square inch, higher pressure than the wider tires. So I think that sort of rings true to me. But There are plastic bottles at the sides of every road. You will find them on trails. You will find them everywhere. Hell, you may even have one with you that you're using, a Gatorade bottle, something like that. It's really easy to find that kind of a thing. It's yet another way to sort of save a tour, maybe get you to the next town. But I'll be honest, I think this rings really true to me, what Mike suggests. You duct tape that sucker in. That's probably going to give you a really nice shield. It's got some heft to it, and that's not going to tear, and that should hold pretty well for a while, especially if you're riding on those thicker tires. If you are on a skinnier tired bike, you may want to consider just going with the dollar bill trick. That will probably get you at least to the next town. You're probably on a skinnier tire going to have to address that a little bit sooner. But I'd be interested if anybody's ever tried something like this, because this one was new to me. So thank you, Mike Cobb, even though you may not listen to the show. I hope you do. But he was on one of the Facebook bicycle touring forums, and that idea came along. So good stuff on Gear Talk this week. Told you, big long segment, lots of good stuff. Next up, we got a mega connection segment. This is when I give some shout outs to people who get in touch with the show. New listener, Mark Van Rom. Hi, Mark. He says, hi, Tim. I'm a new listener and I'm really enjoying the podcast. I live in Hampton, Virginia. I'm about 7 months from retirement. I've been commuting to work since 1993 and did my first century in 1995. I have done 13 week-long supported tours, 6 in Georgia, 1 in Iowa, 5 in the Florida Keys, and 1 in Ohio. Man, that's awesome. Only once in all these tours have I had to set up my own tent. The rest of the time, I used a service that moved my bag, set up my tent, and provided an air mattress. This morning, I went to an REI in Richmond, Virginia, and test rode the Safari. It wasn't in my size, but I am impressed, and I'm thinking about buying one. The tires are really wide. Yes, they are. And that is awesome. Trust me. I would be adding it to my stable of a Cannondale road bike, a Trek 7.3 hybrid commuting bike, and a Bachetta Euro SWB recumbent. Boy, this guy's got a ton of awesome bikes. My reason for wanting the Safari is to use it next summer during an 8-day long Erie Canal ride put out by the New York Parks. Now, let me pause on this for a moment. He is doing the ride that I was a couple of days ahead of last summer. And it is a really cool, it is an enormous, enormous group ride. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of riders, but it's usually really, really well regarded. And you camp at like different high schools and stuff and different parks along the way, along the canal. It's supposed to be really great. So he's doing that next year. Back to Mark. I'm also planning to ride the Southern Tier from San Diego to St. Augustine in 2017. After I retire, I'm planning on doing it supported. So Mark's very big on the supported tours. That's awesome. I just listened to your Border to Border podcast and I'm adding it to my ride list. I grew up in San Francisco and love to do that ride self-supported. Thanks for all the hard work. Yeah, that the Pacific Coast ride is amazing. It's I would say, I wouldn't call it easy to do self-supported, but it's certainly amongst one of the better ones to do in terms of the real distance. If you're thinking, you know, the Northern Tier, Southern Tier, Trans Am, Pacific and Atlantic Coast, I would say of all of those, I would say just based on what I know, that would probably be the easiest of them to do self-supported just with what's around you. You've got lots of camping options and you've got lots of towns. It's a nice mix of that. Atlantic Coast, you don't have as many camping options. You've got a lot of cities and a lot of stuff to go through and the riding is a little bit more tricky. And the cross-country ones, you've got some few and far between issues around there. So if you're thinking of doing something amongst these rides as self-supported, that Pacific ride is really great. Yeah, I'm really interested in hearing more from people who are doing more of the organized rides, more of the supported rides. As we talked about on last episode, I've done one, found out it wasn't quite my fit. At least in that one instance, you know, I talked about it when it was raining and cold and I would absolutely have taken a day off myself if it was just me by myself, you know, I couldn't do that because I had a whole bunch of other people that were there. I mean, I guess I could have dropped out and I could have told somebody, but I don't think they would have been too happy about that. Plus, you know, paid for all the support, so I would be losing all of that. Anyways, Mark, this is great. And I also want to reiterate, I think that it's awesome to do bike touring any way that feels good to you. So if supported tours are your thing, that is awesome. I think that Erie Canal one, that's so well regarded, and wave to Fairport, New York when you go through. That's where I grew up. Next up, listener Purse. He is AKA Steve Brett. He says, just a quick message to thank you for your podcast. Thank you, Steve. I usually listen in the car in the commute to work. Okay, both hands on the wheel, buddy. Do that. Hoping that in 2016, I'll be fit enough to ride instead of driving through. Although a 70 plus mile round trip might be a tall order, think of driving halfway. Yeah, 70 miles, you know, if you're going to go 35 in each direction, you know, usually that means you're doing it in about 10 miles per hour, I find. So that's a 3.5 hour ride before and after your work day. That's a lot. So consider all of these things and consider your pace, I would say. Back to Steve. For years, I've been planning doing the end-to-end in 16 days. That's 1,000 miles from Land's End, England. For those of you who are in the States or don't know Land's End, that is the very, very southern tip of England. To John O'Groats in Scotland. That's an epic sounding ride. Your advice and inspirational stories in the podcast have been useful in deciding in a self-supported tour. I've done a 5-day credit card tour of East Anglia? Anglia? Oh, boy, I'm terrible with geography. Riding through the counties of Essex, Cambridgeshire, Norfolk, Suffolk, and back to Essex. So I have a little idea of what to expect. Yeah, you know, if you could handle that, I find that once you get into the self-supported realm, if you can go a few days, you can do more. In fact, you really get into a rhythm after the first few days, I find. So I think that'll be really cool. So Steve says, hopefully in 2016, end-to-end will happen. Wishing you all the best and a great Christmas. Thank you, Steve. And he is from Chelmsford, Essex, UK. So thank you for our international listeners for throwing that all out. That end-to-end ride sounds really, really cool. I told Steve offline when I emailed him back that I've considered doing a ride around Ireland at some point, including the North and the Republic, and just doing a whole loop of the island. I think that would be a really interesting ride. It's a bit of my heritage in there. And I've seen a lot of crazy guy on a bike journals doing the Ireland ride, but the end-to-end ride sounds really cool too. So that might end up on one of my long-term lists as well. So awesome. Thanks for getting in touch, Steve, and happy new year to you. Thanks for getting in touch. Let's see what else we got. We have the hammer hiker, Dave Rutter. Dave's from around the area where I'm right now. I'm recording from my cabin in West Virginia. He's out, I believe, out towards Ohio Pile along the Great Allegheny Passage. So he's maybe not exactly in the neighborhood, but in that direction. So Dave writes, just wanted to express my gratitude to your podcast. I'm a 47-year-old police officer who just got into biking. I live near Ohio Pile and started renting bikes to take short trips, an hour long, on the gap. I was rehabbing a work-related knee injury and found that biking was the only way to help my knee. The bikes at the gym were boring, agreed, and my son had just bought a track bike. It was like a Cadillac. I love that. I never knew that the new bikes were so light and responsive. I rented a specialized bike at Ohio Pile and went for a ride. I ended up buying 3 used bikes for under $1,000, best purchase I ever made. Started listening to your podcast at the Y on the stationary bike, and it got me excited. And I've done the entire gap in overnight sections and am planning on doing an end-to-end trip in the spring. I also did the Frostburg to Cumberland section several times. That's the area that's got the big hill, for those of you who don't know the gap very well. We rode the train back once and hired a shuttle to take us from Cumberland to Deal, Pennsylvania. I think if some of your listeners knew just how easy that section is, they would take that trip first. 25 plus miles downhill, a kid's dream. Anyways, thanks and keep up the great work. And that is from Hammer Hiker, Dave Rutter. Dave, I totally agree. That downhill is so epically awesome. It's so funny because I do love a good downhill. When I do the gap, I think I've talked about this before, I love doing it in the DC to from Cumberland to Pittsburgh. And that's just because I find the other direction coming up, if you're doing a through ride, it's just this long, constant pedal. You don't get any chance for a glide or a rest. You're always pedaling. And I always tend to catch it in a little bit of rain. And so when it's got a little bit of softness to that trail, that long 80, 90 plus miles can be really tough on me. So I prefer doing that one big hill. I can do that in a few hours because I think it's about 20, 25 miles, like you said, up that hill. And then you're at a bit of a grade going downhill or flat for the rest of the ride to Pittsburgh. So that's why I always like doing it in that direction. But I know lots of people prefer the other direction, and I bobbed down that hill. I have done it, and it is pretty epic. So yeah, I agree. If you are thinking of trying the gap at any point, and the gap, of course, I always realize I keep talking as if everybody knows what I'm talking about. The gap is the Great Allegheny Passage that's going from Cumberland to Pittsburgh. It is a really great trail. It is cut off during most of the winter. One of the tunnels, the Savage Tunnel, Great Savage Tunnel, is closed off from about, December-ish or so until April. So you'll have to wait until the spring until that opens up again. But if you want to do the end-to-end ride, it's a really good one. And as Dave says, if you go the direction towards Cumberland, Maryland, you get an epic downhill all the way down to Cumberland. You work for it, but you get there, and it's pretty great. So thanks, Dave, for writing in, and good luck on all your plans. I think that's really great. I love first-timers. I love people who are learning from the show, so that's awesome. Next we can have more 5 stars. Hey, you guys really like the show. And I got one of my favorites. I got 3 more 5-star reviews in iTunes. Let me pull those up because I've got the small ones and then I can't read too well because, of course, I'm an aging person who can't read a font that is below 6 points. So this is better. The first one, this is my favorite. And it is from a friend of the show, Brock, over at the Sprocket Podcast, because I can tell by his handle, Brockman. Number 1-star review. Now, it is a 5-star review. However, he says, this podcast did not pedal my bicycle for me or shift its gears. I want a refund. That was awesome. I'm going to have more of those. So if you want to do fake 1-star reviews, please feel free to do that. But, you know, it'd be nice if you gave me the 5-star and then gave me the 1-star text. That would be awesome. Just like Brock did. Thank you, sir. I'll see you in February, by the way. I'll be in Portland in February. So we're going to be doing, I don't know if we're going to do a crossover show, but we'll, one of our podcasts, probably theirs, will at least have me on it. So next up, SL Craven, modern old school bike touring radio, 5 stars again. Awesome. Thank you. It only took me about 30 years to get back into cycling, but this time without the fast racing attitude I used to have. I'm not really a tourer, but I am a rider who is enjoying his substantially slower and shorter rides. This podcast is not only interesting, by the way, Brock, interesting, not interesting, interesting. It's also inspiring, making me want to go out for longer rides. And the production values are great. Think NPR. Good Lord, sir. You just made everybody who listens, who works for NPR, very unhappy. However, I thank you for that because I work hard on this. Anyways, anyone interested in cycling will enjoy this podcast. Thank you, SL Craven. First of all, it warms the subcockles of my heart to hear somebody think that my production is anywhere near NPR. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. If you saw what I was doing right now, I'm talking into a closet, literally into a closet right now to try to get you that better sound. So thank you. And keep listening. I'm excited. You know, hey, and by the way, I'm glad that you don't need to be a tourer to listen to the show. I hope I'm doing some cool, inspiring talk with all of this. So thank you for listening. Last but not least, T-Biggs. T-Biggs says, let the adventures begin. 5 stars. Great podcast. Very informative and entertaining. A buddy and I are planning to ride from Pittsburgh to DC next year, and finding the podcast has been very helpful in planning. Growing up in DC, I biked the other trails in the area, but never the CNO towpath. Can't wait to get back and explore the CNO and Gap. Keep up the great work. T-Biggs, thank you very much. You have come to the right place because I talk about those two trails, I think, just about every episode, it feels like, because they're in my backyard and I do them all the time and they're really great. More to come, and probably we'll have at least another tour journal here in 2016, at least one, maybe even more, that will explore some or all of the Gap and the CNO. So stay tuned and good luck on your ride. That is awesome. Quick little bit of housekeeping before we close out the show. Reminder, next week, 1 week from today, when this podcast comes out, that will be on always on Thursdays at 7 a.m. That's the time when it comes out, whether it's on the every other week schedule or as we've been doing on the weekly schedule here. We're going to have part 2 of Mysterious James. We got some really good stuff that we left on the table. We actually considered it as an after show, but it ended up being so long and so good, it's going to be an entire new podcast. So if you like part 1, definitely listen to part 2. If you hated part 1, give part 2 a real shot because it's really good. And Mysterious James really was more relaxed in the second one, I think, because we just sort of like, I just put the mic up and we just talked, and it's awesome. I think you'll really like it. So that'll be in a week. If you are interested in having more podcasts than I normally put out, make sure you sign up for the Pedal Shift newsletter. Now, on the 15th of every month, I shouldn't say that. In the middle of every month, I'm going to be putting out a new special show just for podcast listeners who also are subscribed to the newsletter. So that was kind of confusing. If you subscribed in the newsletter, there's an extra podcast in it for you. It's, I'll have a feed that you can subscribe to if you'd like, or you'll just get an email with the audio file attached to it. It's going to be really cool. Usually I'm going to be doing some sort of like, I don't know, top 10 lists, top 5 things, things that are just interesting related to bike touring. Or if there's any kind of specific news or something, I don't want to kind of limit myself too much, but I've got some good things for the February and January newsletters. Of course, the January is going to be coming, I want to say sometime mid-month. It may even come out prior to this show. It just sort of depends on how the calendar goes. I'm also going to be going to Florida for a quick trip. So my time is going to be a little crazy. So hopefully this will all come out and you'll all get it. But definitely sign up now at when you get this, and you will probably have access to the January one if you sign up in the very near future. So that's that for the Pedal Shift Project episode 40. Thank you so much for joining, and we'll see you next week. Thank you for joining. You can find PedalShift at pedalshift.net. Lots of great content. You can hear the PedalShift Project through iTunes or your favorite podcast aggregator. Opening music courtesy of Jason Kent off his debut album. The track is called America. Check out his band Sunfield's latest release, Habitat, wherever cool music is available.